Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the Center for Jewish Life on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Dan Efron, author of Killing a King, the subject of which is the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin by Orthodox Jew Yigal Amir 20 years ago. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Jewish Life and the Jewish Federation of Omaha, and part of Omaha's 42nd year of celebrating Jewish Book Month, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday evening, November 30th, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Jewish Life, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Steve Abraham, rabbi at Beth El Synagogue.
This evening we have a rare opportunity to hear from Dan Efron, who is an award-winning writer. Dan served as the Jerusalem bureau chief for both Newsweek magazine and the Daily Beast, and now lives in New York City. At Newsweek, he served as a national security correspondent and deputy bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. His stories have also been featured in the Boston Globe, the New Republic, and Esquire magazine. As I mentioned to Dan earlier, I was not dating myself, but being only 15 years old when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, that has been the narrative of my time knowing the state of Israel. And it's a fascinating story to be able to see that arc of the history of his assassination, as well as where the state is today, as well as perhaps where it is 25 years from now. And so I am thrilled that Dan is able to be here. I also want to thank the CJEL at the Federation for their support in this program, as well as the Jewish Book Council. And so if you could put your hands together to welcome Dan Efron.
Thank you. First of all, thank you so much. It's not great weather, although for you people, I suppose you're used to this. I grew up in California. This is far colder than the coldest day I ever experienced growing up. I'm going to tell you sort of the backstory of the book that I wrote, Killing a King, which is about the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. This is sort of like the making of, you know, the way you would see a film that is the making of another film. I'm going to tell you how I came to make this book or to write the book. And before I do, let me just ask, how many of you roughly remember that day, the day of the assassination? It was 20 years ago, November 4th. Yeah, all of you, almost all of you. And then how many of you have been to Israel? Okay. Great. So the geography I'll talk about will be familiar to most of you. And then here's the last question. My wife is also a journalist. We collaborated on a piece for the radio show This American Life. Are there listeners to This American Life? Yeah, a lot. Okay. Anyone hear that piece? It aired about a month ago. Okay, great. So now I know. Here's how this started for me. I was the Jerusalem bureau chief for Newsweek magazine from 2010 to 2013. Somewhere in the middle there, around 2012, I was on deadline. I had to finish a story for the magazine. It was one of those days where you're on deadline. I was on deadline and I had to be very productive to get things done by that evening. And I don't know how you guys are, but sometimes when I need to be very productive, I go online and type in YouTube, and then somehow magically a whole afternoon gets wasted on, you know, all sorts of binge clicking. On this particular day, one of the things that I clicked on was a video of the interrogation of Yigal Amir. I got there, you know, in the ways that you get to things, not meaning to start there, but you start with the thing that you like, and that leads you to something else, and invariably, you're clicking on animals, cats and panda bears. Anyway, eventually I got to Rabin, and it's a very short clip that I saw. It's a 20-second clip of the interrogation, and it shows Yigal Amir, the assassin, who was 25 at the time. He was a law student. When he killed Rabin, it shows the assassin in the room, in the police interrogation room, maybe 15 or 20 minutes after the shooting. It's not even clear yet that Rabin is dead. Rabin is shot at the end of a peace rally in Tel Aviv. And he's rushed to the hospital. Yigal Amir is rushed to the police station. And in this 20-second clip on YouTube, you can hardly, you know, it's very hard to make out. Amir is somewhere in the shadow. You can sort of see him. You hear him. The audio is good, but the video is pretty bad. But I found it mesmerizing. I found it mesmerizing because I had been at that rally in 1995. I was a journalist reporting from Israel at the time, and I covered that rally thinking that this was going to be a 3 or 4 paragraph story. Political rallies are not very interesting for foreign correspondents. They're not very interesting because, you know, politicians stand up, they make speeches. In Israel, rallies often include like pop bands on the stage alongside the politician. So you have a politician delivering a speech, and then you have a band coming on and playing a very kind of upbeat song, sort of somber speech, upbeat song. It goes back and forth, and then it's over. But on this particular day, it was 1995, November. It was about 2 years since the start of the Oslo peace process. That deal that Rabin and Arafat seal with a handshake on the White House lawn in 1993. You probably remember that image of Clinton kind of almost physically nudging the two men together. So it had been about 2 years since then. That peace process, the popularity of that process went up and down. It waxed and waned. And so did the popularity of Rabin, of the Israeli leader. It was up when it felt like that process generated a sense of hope, like maybe this situation of perpetual war that Israel found itself in might finally be ebbing or even ending. Then the peace process was popular, so was Rabin. But the Oslo deal also prompted violence on both sides. This is the period of Hamas and the suicide bombings, where they get quite bad. And so for Israelis, when the process is associated with violence, of course, the popularity of the process goes down. So this rally in November 1995, for a news person, was a litmus test. It was a way to gauge where is Rabin, where is the process in terms of Israeli public opinion. I had envisioned writing just a few paragraphs that said either very few people show up to the rally, and what does that say? Or a lot of people show up. I left my home. I lived in a rental apartment in Tel Aviv. I left my home. I walked a few blocks from the apartment towards the square. This was the Kings of Israel Square. I asked about Israel because if you've been to Tel Aviv, you probably know. It's that square right in the center of Tel Aviv near the municipality building. Today it's called Rabin Square, but it was called the Kings of Israel Square at the time, and it's about the size of a few football fields. So if you haven't been there, you can imagine it. And almost as soon as I left my apartment, I realized this was going to be a big event. There were people streaming from all the side streets to the square. And when I got there, there was a huge crowd, about 100,000 people. And I did what journalists do. I walked around in the crowd. I talked to people. I looked at signs and wrote down what the signs said. Then I went on stage where Rabin and others were, and I interviewed some of the politicians. And then the rally was over. Rallies end with the singing of the Israeli national anthem, Hatikva. They sang Hatikva, and people started leaving, including journalists. And I got a few blocks away, heading back towards my apartment, intending to write this story. And then I got a message on a beeper, on my beeper, which some of you might remember, a little black box, hangs on your belt, one line of text. And the message said, "Shots fired near Rabin, head back." I was a young journalist. This was somewhere in the beginning of my career. So this assassination I covered, from there I ran back to the stage and then to the parking lot where people said this is where he was shot. And then I ran from there to the hospital, to Ichilov Hospital. It's a few blocks away, and was there for the announcement about an hour and a half nearly after the shooting, the announcement that Rabin had died. This had a big impact on me. It was a big event. Certainly in Israel, But also as a journalist, it stuck in my mind. So now, fast forward, 2012, I'm in Israel, I watch this video, and things come rushing back. I'm going to show you the video. Again, I spoke a lot about it. I built it up, so you're going to expect quite a lot. You don't see a lot. But let's go through it, and then we'll talk about it. So Amir is on the left. So yeah, Amir is on the left. You see, he's sort of rocking back and forth. He's delivering his confession. Who speaks Hebrew here, by the way? A couple of you. So what he's saying is, everything I did out of a sense of my religious obligation. And on the right, there's four police detectives. Now, I think one thing that struck me here was just how calm Amir is. Because, you know, one thing I remembered was that the assassination had really plunged Israel into a state of shock, a real trauma. There's no tradition of political assassination in Israel. I think to the extent that anyone thought that an Israeli leader might be murdered, might be assassinated, people expected it to come from a Palestinian. It was clear very quickly, within a few minutes, that the shooter, even before it was clear that Rabin died, it was clear that the shooter was an Israeli, a fellow Jew, a religious extremist. So the country is reeling. And reeling instantly. People talk about the Rabin assassination maybe sort of as Israel's Kennedy assassination. In most ways, it's not like the Kennedy assassination. The motives are different. The circumstances are quite different. But in this way, it's similar. It's that moment that people remember. They remember where they were. They remember the shock of it, that fear of what does this mean for my country? Where is my country going as a result? So all that is happening outside the police station, everywhere in Israel. But inside, Amir is very calm. And he's calm because Amir defied the odds. He defied the odds by killing Rabin. So now, I told you my story for that evening, how I left my apartment. Let me tell you Amir's story. He was this young man who, on the night that the Oslo deal was signed at the White House, that moment 2 years earlier, he was at home with his brother, his older brother, 2 years older than him. They're in the second story of the house where they grew up with their parents. They still live there. They're both university students. And they're watching this ceremony on television. And Amir says to his brother, this is a betrayal. It's a betrayal of Israel by Rabin and his government, and it's a betrayal of Judaism. For Amir, of course, this is a big security risk that Rabin is plunging the country into, but also the very idea of some accommodation with the Palestinians that involves giving back some parts of the West Bank and Gaza. And we'll talk a little bit more about this and what Oslo was. That very idea was a betrayal of Judaism because this was territory that God promised to the Jews. Part of the Jewish birthright. And Amir tells his brother, we have to stop this, and we're going to organize rallies, and we're going to do various things, but if that doesn't work, I'm willing to kill him and pay the price for it if necessary. He says that 2 years earlier already with the signing of the deal. And then he spends this two-year period, he's a student at Bar-Ilan University, so he's very active in politics. He's organizing protests on campus. He's also taking big groups of students out to the West Bank, to settlements in the West Bank. But he's also stalking Rabin. He's also going to places where Rabin is speaking publicly. Amir reads in the newspaper that there's an event where the prime minister will be, and the prime minister is going to speak. And Amir takes his gun. He is a former infantry soldier. He served in an infantry group, a brigade, the Golani Infantry Brigade. And he carries a little Beretta, a 9mm Beretta, everywhere he goes. And he's going to different places where Rabin shows up and looking for an opportunity and asking himself, is this what God intended for me? And if God did intend this for me, he will show me. He will create an opportunity. On the night of the rally, Amir reads about the rally. He knows that Rabin will be there. He leaves his home on, this is Saturday night, so he leaves his home around 7:30. He takes a bus from Herzliya, where his parents live, where he lives with his parents, to Tel Aviv. He takes off his skull cap because this is a rally of Israelis on the left and center left, tend to be secular, and he wants to blend in. He doesn't want to stick out. So he takes off his skull cap and puts it in his pocket. And then he walks around and he walks by the parking lot behind the stage and he sees a Cadillac. And he knows this is Rabin's Cadillac because Rabin had spent the first 2.5 years of his term as the prime minister being driven around in a Chevy Caprice. And Rabin loved the Caprice. It was fast. It was comfortable. But in the months leading up to the assassination, there is intelligence information about the possibility that people on the right or the far right who oppose his peace deals might try to harm him or even assassinate him. There is this kind of threat of intelligence. And so his Secret Service people, his bodyguards, persuade Rabin that they need to import an armored Cadillac like the one that President Clinton was driven around in at the same time here. And when they bring the Cadillac into the country, the main television stations go to the port and they film it. So everyone knows Rabin is now being ferried around in a Cadillac. And by the way, he hates it. He hates the Cadillac because it's lumbering and slow and the windows are thick. It's hard to see out through the windows. Amir sees the Cadillac and he says, okay, if the car is here, this is where Rabin will end up. And he waits there and he gets into the parking lot, even though it's a parking lot that's supposed to be secure, only for Secret Service people and policemen, some of the roadies who are handling equipment for the stage. No one else is supposed to get in. He manages to get in. It's a security lapse. Other people are getting in as well, people who are eager to get a glimpse of Rabin. So the parking lot, Amir is there for about 40 minutes. So are other people in addition to the security people who are supposed to be there. He waits 40 minutes. Nobody comes to him. Nobody asks what he's doing. He watches Rabin come down the stairs from the stage after the rally. He circles behind Rabin. Rabin is surrounded by 4 or 5 bodyguards. Amir sees a gap between the 2 trailing bodyguards. He gets close enough. He pulls out his gun and reaches out to within about a foot of the prime minister and then fires 3 shots. 2 bullets go into Rabin's back, and 1 bullet hits the bodyguard. Now, Amir had taken into account that he might die in this shooting, that the drive or the quest to assassinate the prime minister could well end up with his own death. For him, it was a suicide mission, and he was willing to die, and yet he's alive. Secret Servicemen pull out their guns. Nobody fires. There's a lot of people in the parking lot, and so nobody fires a shot. And so Amir is alive. And so now he's in the police station, and he's telling himself, I beat the odds. I managed to get into the parking lot. I managed to get close enough to the prime minister to fire my gun, and I wasn't killed. That tells me that God wanted me to do this. That's why he's very, very calm. Now, I watched this, and I told myself, okay, if there's 20 seconds of it, there's probably hours of it. Because if police turned on the camera to videotape the interrogation, they probably left it on. I thought if I could get a chance to view some number of hours of the interrogation of Yigal Amir, maybe I could write a magazine story. Maybe there was something about his psyche that I could understand that other people had not come to understand before. And eventually I got a chance to watch more of the interrogation. I'll show you another video that's a little clearer. So that's Amir on the right.
Okay.
And this interrogator, this is already a couple of weeks after the assassination, and this interrogator on the left, a different interrogator, they're talking and they discover that they went to the same university at the same time, even though the interrogator is about 20 years older than Amir. He went back to school to do a master's degree in criminology, this interrogator. Eventually got a chance to interview him. And so part of this conversation, they're saying, oh, you were there, you know, between 93 and 95. Did you have this professor? Did you know this person? And one of the things this interrogator tells me is it's very, very important to establish a rapport with the suspect. And so even though he was enraged at what Amir had done, he's trying to build that rapport and kind of stay very calm. Now let me go back to this other frame for a second. Okay. So I managed to view these tapes. I think they told me quite a lot. What unspools in the course of these tapes is the entire story of the assassination. The whole story I told you about Amir and what he does for the 2 years leading up to the murder. And it unspools because, for one thing, Amir is just happy to confess. He's very proud of what he did, and he's from the very first moment, in fact, already in the police car on the way to the station, he wants to talk about what he did and why he did, and to talk about this religious justification, which is what you heard here. So that's one reason it was very interesting and useful to me. But also, when policemen interrogate a suspect, a lot of the questions they ask are very similar to what I would ask as a journalist. You know, I want to know, what did you do? When did you do it? But I also want to know, what were you thinking when you left your house that day? Or when did the thought of killing Rabin first come to mind? And that's the very thing that interrogators want to know, because they want to establish motive. They want to get to the suspect's mental state. So all these things come out in the interrogation. Now, the other thing that comes out is that the other people here it's hard to make out here, but they are people who were involved in the interrogation. They're still alive. It's an event that happened, just 20 years ago. So for a journalist, for me, it was very clear that I could go back and interview these people. Now, there's a guy on the right in the white shirt. He's sort of in the center of the table. He's the lead interrogator. And I thought, I watched the interaction between him and Amir and found it interesting and thought, okay, how do I find him in order to interview him? And by now, I had enough material that the thought came to mind that maybe this was not just an article for Newsweek, but maybe this was a book. And I watched enough of it. At some point, I saw that he reaches down, the guy on the right reaches down and picks up a pipe and puts it in his mouth. Now, I had lived in Israel off and on for chunks of time, never met a pipe smoker. Israelis are not pipe smokers. They're cigarette smokers, but not pipe smokers. And so it was very easy to find him because I started talking to policemen who had been around in the 90s, and it was enough to ask a couple of people. So there was this police interrogator, mid-90s, pipe smoker. Do you know who that might be? And the answer very quickly was Moti Naftali. I caught up to Moti Naftali. He's retired by now. He lives in a town south of Tel Aviv. Really smart guy. Speaks a few languages. Had spent some time in Germany as the police emissary to Germany. And a windsurfer, by the way. He had told me, I wanted to interview him, and he said the wind was good that day, so don't come on that day. But eventually I did go, and he talked about what it was like that evening, interrogating Amir for the first time. And I'm going to play part of that for you. And keep in mind here that he's describing these moments where it's not clear yet that Rabin is dead. And then he describes the moment where he finds out from another policeman that Rabin has died on the operating table, and he tells Amir this.
One of my my police came in and brought me a cup of tea with a kalkar, white kalkar,
styrofoam cup.
Yeah. And I told to him, would you also like a cup of tea? And said, yes. And I told him, bring another one, please. And he brought him the cup of tea. And he says, don't you have cookies? And I told him, oh, you are pushing your luck. I remember his reaction when I told him, when I accuse him, and I tell him, Moti Naftali accuse you that you shot the prime minister and you caused his death. And he was shocked to hear it. He said, what? Did he die? Wow, and he jumped like your team make a goal.
Like your team scored a goal in a soccer game.
Yeah. And this moment, you want to come and punch him in the face. But you must be correct. You must sit down. Sit down. Would you like a cup of tea? Let's make l'chaim, he said.
Let's make a toast.
Let's make a toast.
Yeah. L'chaim means to life. To make a toast to life.
Yeah, to life. To life that he took.
And that voice, by the way, is the voice of my wife, Nancy. She is also a journalist, and this particular interview we did for the radio show, and we collaborated on that radio show. So you hear Amir describing, you hear Naftali describing this interaction with Amir and how shocked he himself is. And by the way, one of the things I got a chance to do is, in addition to interviews, in addition to the tapes, is review a bunch of police documents that had to do with the assassination. This is one of them. And this gets, again, at the mental state of Amir. Whenever there's an investigation, police will put some number of investigators on the case. And whenever any of the investigators does anything that has to do with the investigation, the investigator will write up a memo. I called the suspect's friend, told her we wanted to question her. She said she will come down to the station tomorrow. He writes that in a memo and puts it in the file. And the file gets bigger and bigger. It's these big binders, and eventually one copy of all the binders goes to the prosecuting attorney, another copy goes to the defense attorney. So this was one of the documents, one of the memos that I found in the file. If you see, it's hard to make out, but the top left-hand corner, it says 4/11/95. Israelis write the date in reverse. They write the day and then the month and then the year. So this is November 4th. It's the night of the assassination. And this is written by the lab technician who took the fingerprints of Yigal Amir that night. So again, it's 10 or 15 minutes after the assassination. And the lab technician writes, the suspect came to my lab. I told him, put your fingers down on the ink pad. And as he did, the suspect noticed that his watch is missing. And the suspect turned to me, to the lab technician, and said, I think back in the parking lot when I shot the prime minister, my watch must have fallen off. Can you radio back there? And see if there are policemen who are still in the parking lot, if someone can find it and retrieve it and bring it back to me. So this is a little bit about Yigal Amir. Now, by the way, I mentioned his brother. We said that they were in the same room. They watched that ceremony. And they're plotting the murder together. The brother is 2 years older. His name is Haggai. And eventually he's convicted as a co-conspirator. He spent 16 and a half years in prison. He wasn't at the rally that night. He didn't go to the rally, but they plot the murder together. They talk about different ways to kill Rabin over the course of these 2 years leading up to the assassination. And Haggai gets out of prison just around the time that I was watching that first YouTube video. And I interviewed him once and then interviewed him many other times, several other times, because he was a central figure in the assassination. You can't interview Yigal Amir in prison. The Israeli prison service won't allow journalists into the prison to interview him. And so in some ways, Haggai was the closest I could come to actually understanding the assassin himself. And he's an interesting guy in a way that surprised me. I think I had thought of the Amir brothers as sort of marginal figures. He's not very smart, kind of rough around the edges, these ruffians, these tough guys. In fact, both of them are quite smart. They were smart young men, steeped in scripture. They knew the Torah very well. They knew the Talmud very well. And thoughtful in a political way. I mean, you know, thoughtful in that erudite way where they think deeply about things. And I think this surprised me quite a lot and disturbed me quite a lot. It was really, the series of interviews with him, I think, was, you know, one of the more disturbing interviews I've done in my career as a journalist. The family really opened up and cooperated and showed me photos of Amir. Okay, so by now, with all this material, it's quite clear to me that there is material here for a book, that the combination of having been to the rally that night and remembering it very well, it really left this impression on me, and the fact that there was all this material 20 years later, and that Israel was a different place 20 years later, all that appealed to me. You know, these moments where something happens, where history is going in a certain direction, and a small event happens that kicks it off course, are some of the most interesting moments in history. It was clear to me that I wanted to write a narrative. I didn't want to write a policy book that analyzes things. I wanted to get to the story itself. And that story has two protagonists. There's Amir and there's Rabin. And both of these protagonists are on a quest. They're both trying to achieve something. Rabin is out trying to get these peace deals locked up between Israel and its neighbors, between Israel and the Palestinians, but also Israel and Jordan, Israel and Syria, and even Israel and Lebanon. And Amir is on his own quest. He's on a quest to stop Rabin before all this goes forward. So who is Rabin? Rabin was born in 1922 in Mandatory Palestine, before it was Israel. And he is a military man for the first three decades of his life. He rises in the ranks of the Israeli military until he heads the entire military. He is the chief of staff in the 1960s and during the 1967 war, the Six-Day War. That's that pivotal moment when Israel captures the West Bank and Gaza, but also the Sinai and the Golan Heights, vast tracts of territory. But the West Bank and Gaza is the significant part because that's the territory, or at least parts of it, that he's negotiating with the Palestinians over many years later. Rabin retires from the military and becomes the Israeli ambassador to the United States. This is a photo of him on Meet the Press as the Israeli ambassador. It's 1970. This is, you know, the Nixon administration. Rabin gets quite close to Nixon and to Kissinger. Nixon has him to the White House a number of times to discuss the American war, America's war in Vietnam, and Nixon wants advice from Rabin what to do about it. Rabin finishes his term as the ambassador. He goes back to Israel and he becomes prime minister at a relatively young age, without a lot of political experience. And it's not a very successful period for him as prime minister. He says so himself. He writes a memoir later where he says, "I was inexperienced. I didn't do well in my first term." And then he's in the wilderness. He's in the political wilderness for some number of years. He starts to make a comeback in the 80s as defense minister. And he's defense minister in this critical time in the late 1980s, during the time of the first Palestinian uprising. This uprising, the first Palestinian uprising, begins in late 1987 with big demonstrations, big protests by Palestinians across the West Bank and Gaza, a lot of stone throwing and petrol bombs mostly, not the suicide bombings, that comes later. And Rabin's response is to order a very aggressive crackdown against the Palestinians and against the uprising. Rabin is not a leftist. He doesn't regard himself as a kind of softy or a peacenik. I think all these terms would be anathema for him. He's a military man who's very, very concerned about Israel's security. And in fact, that is who he remains, I think, in his constitution until the day he died. One of his family members, his daughter, told me that Rabin used to sit on the edge of his bed every morning and shine his own shoes. These old habits from the military that die hard. Rabin orders this very aggressive crackdown against the Palestinians in this first intifada, but he comes to two conclusions as a result of this uprising, two conclusions that sort of shift his view politically. One is that he feels that the Palestinians will never settle for Israeli military rule over millions of Palestinians, that condition that had existed since 1967 in the West Bank and Gaza. The Palestinians won't settle for it. And in order to sustain it, Israel will have to live by the sword forever. That's his first conclusion. His second conclusion is, and he writes about this in articles and in speeches, his second conclusion is that that condition of military rule over millions of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, that it was toxic for Israeli society, that it wasn't doing anything good for Israeli society. And so now he becomes prime minister in 1992, and the Oslo process begins secretly. It's these secret negotiations. They're hatched not by Rabin. They're initiated by Rabin's foreign minister, Shimon Peres. And very quickly, Peres discloses the talks to Rabin. And Rabin has this moment where he has to decide, do you embrace them or do you reject them? And it's a complicated decision, in part because Peres is his political rival, in part, of course, because Israel is now talking secretly to the PLO, to this organization that embodies, for Israel, embodies terrorism, to Yasser Arafat, the arch-terrorist. And he decides to embrace it, and he says, if you're going to make peace, you make peace with your enemies. And this is what brings him to the White House. The relationship between Rabin and Clinton does not begin well. It's hard to think of two men who are more different. Rabin is, he's gruff. He's got this kind of military demeanor. He's not good at small talk, not a very charismatic man, very direct. And then Clinton, think of what you know about Clinton. He's sort of a larger-than-life figure, never served in the military, baby boomer. But the relationship becomes very close. Clinton writes in his memoir that he had come to view Rabin as a kind of father figure. This is a moment in 1995 when Rabin is in Washington. He comes to Washington to attend a black tie event. He walks in and realizes black tie means tuxedos, and he's in just a suit and tie. And so Clinton looks around. He looks at one of Clinton's bodyguards, his Secret Service men, and he says, "You take off your bow tie." And the bodyguard takes off the bow tie and gives it to Rabin. Of course, Rabin doesn't know how to tie a bow tie, which no judgment. I don't know how to tie a bow tie either. And so Clinton leans in and helps him tie the bow tie. This is the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in 1994. It's a year after the signing of the Oslo deal. And Rabin is sharing it with Shimon Peres, his foreign minister, and with Yasser Arafat. And look at Rabin's face. Not terribly happy. Mainly not happy to be sharing the stage with Peres. Rabin, his advisors in interviews told me that he, and there was a big dilemma here by the committee that doles out the Peace Prize, whether to give it to Rabin and Arafat or the three of them. They knew about the rivalry. They didn't want to exacerbate it. Rabin says to one of his advisors, "I don't need Peres along to share the." I think he says, "I don't need Rabin to help. I don't need Peres to help me carry the envelope." Rabin with King Hussein of Jordan. One of the things that the Oslo Agreement does is it creates an opening for Israel, an opening in the Arab world, including in Jordan, which is Israel's neighbor to the east. And King Hussein signs a peace deal with Israel, the agreement between Jordan and Israel, which, by the way, has held up to this day, even through some critical periods, some difficult periods. These two men had a lot in common, military background, and the rapport between them was very, very good. And they're both, of course, heavy smokers. Rabin smoked two packs a day in sort of normal times. When the stress level went up, it would rise. I had a chance to read the pathology report that was written about Rabin after the assassination. And, you know, the pathologist will go through and inspect every inch of the body. And one of the things he writes is that Rabin had these yellow stains between his index finger and his middle finger on both hands. Remember we said that Amir had stalked Rabin over the two-year period leading up to the assassination. So this was one of those events. Amir reads in the paper that there's going to be this ribbon-cutting ceremony and that Rabin will be showing up to cut the ribbon. I think this was an underpass that had just been built, not far, by the way, from Amir's house in Herzliya. And Amir reads about this. He gets into his car. It's actually his brother's car. It's a little VW Bug. And he drives out to the intersection. And he sees some people milling about, but Rabin is not there. And he tells himself, okay, I better drive off. I don't want to create suspicion by standing around. I'll drive away. I'll drive around a little bit, and I'll come back. And by the time Amir comes back, this moment has already happened, and Rabin is gone. Okay, I'm going to show you two more things, and then I'll take some questions. A few weeks after the shooting, after the assassination, police take Amir back to the site of the murder, back to the parking lot behind the stage. And they do that because they want him to reenact the assassination. They want him to show them exactly what he did. Now, by now, there's a lot of evidence that Amir is the shooter. First of all, Amir is confessing. He's confessed throughout this 2 or 3 week period in the interrogation room. But also, police have already gathered forensic evidence. They've spoken to witnesses. Everything lines up. It's very clear that Amir is the shooter. But police are always worried about getting false confessions, about the situation where maybe someone will admit to something, will confess to something that he didn't really do. And so if you've already gathered a bunch of information about the murder and you know, the police know how it happened, and then you take the suspect to the scene and you tell him, okay, tell me, show me how you did it. If he doesn't know exactly what went on there, then you know something is suspicious. So they take Amir to the parking lot and they tell him, okay, show us. And he knows exactly, and he shows them exactly what happens. But what's interesting is Amir's character. And I watched, there's a whole video of this. I watched the whole thing. What you see is him almost acting like a movie director. There are other policemen there who have come along. And the policemen are supposed to be stand-ins for the different people who are in the parking lot that night. The bodyguards, the driver, and so on. And Amir is pointing to people and he's saying, no, you stand over here, you move a little bit to the left, you're going to be Rabin, take another step forward. So we're going to see a very quick video of this. It's maybe 6 seconds long, and it's from an Israeli documentary that aired a few years ago, and so you're going to hear the voiceover in Hebrew.
Adam Boded הצליח לראות בראש הממשלה שהיה שמור על ידי שלושה מאבטחים אישיים.
Okay, so that's Amir in the bulletproof vest, that white sort of bib that's hanging over him. And by the way, they put a bulletproof vest on him because they bring him out at 2 or 3 in the morning. They're worried that Israelis are in a state of rage at the assassination. They're worried that somebody might see him and take a shot at him. And Rabin, by the way, was not wearing a bulletproof vest that night. There's kind of a strange contrast. He is, but Rabin wasn't. Rabin's bodyguards had said, you need to start wearing a bulletproof vest. His security chief told him this starting months before the assassination. But he didn't want to. He refused to. He refused to because he felt that this is his country. This is the country where he was the chief of staff. And he just didn't want to walk around. He didn't believe that somebody could threaten him, certainly not a fellow Israeli, a fellow Jew, and he just refused. He just wouldn't do it. The man in the checkered shirt is the stand-in for Rabin. He's just about to get into his car. It actually isn't exactly like this. Rabin was still erect when he shot. You'll see a video of the assassination in a moment. These other people are all policemen, including the man who's holding a microphone to Amir's mouth. He's asking him, tell me exactly what happened now, and then what did you do, and then what did you do? And by the way, the man in the checkered shirt was the interrogator in the second video we saw. He's coming out to see this. Okay, now I'm going to show you the video of the murder itself. Remember I said that the journalists had all left. I had left, so had other journalists. So there's no news footage of the assassination. But it turned out that there was an amateur photographer standing on the roof of a building that looked down onto the parking lot. Roni Kempler was the photographer. This was his hobby. He liked to go to places where politicians would show up and he would film them. And he trains his camera on the parking lot for several minutes before Rabin comes down, and then he's following Rabin. Now, once again, the video is not great. It's dark. It's hard to make out the characters. You'll see Amir in a red circle. You'll see Rabin kind of coming down the stairs and walking forward. He's wearing glasses, so you can kind of see the metal of his glasses glinting or shining. And then the bodyguards around him. It's not great quality. I don't know if any of you had a chance to see the Zapruder film, the film that shows the assassination of John Kennedy. It's a horrific film, but in some ways it's beautiful because it's very clear. You know, you see the entire street. You see Kennedy riding in the car. You see him getting shot. You see Jackie Kennedy crawling out of the back seat and getting onto the back of the car. You don't really see any of those kinds of images here. But one thing you do see here that you don't in the Zapruder film, because of how close in everything was, because of how close Amir got, you see both the suspect, the shooter, and the victim, Rabin, in the same frame. I'm going to talk over it as we see it so I can just kind of narrate it. Okay, so that's Rabin coming down. You see him in the white shirt with the bald head. He's got two bodyguards in front of him, one in a white shirt and the other in a black jacket. Amir is behind the man in the young man in the white shirt. He's circling behind Rabin. He's in a red circle. He finds that gap between the two bodyguards. There was a young man with curly hair behind Rabin in a white shirt, and Amir kind of circles around him and gets in between the bodyguards. I don't know if you noticed, but that guy was a journalism student, was not supposed to be in the parking lot, managed to get in just like Amir did, to slip into the parking lot. And the journalism student is hoping to get an interview with Rabin, a quick, you know, one question, one answer. He's holding a microphone out. And he kind of calls out his question as Rabin is coming down, and Rabin passes him by and doesn't answer. But the journalism student realizes as he's walking away after the shooting that he's got the audio of the shooting on tape, because he had the tape going the whole time. And he gets home, and he presses rewind, and he starts to play, and he realizes that he had hit the wrong button, and there is no audio. Okay. I'm going to just explain why I called the book Killing a King, and then I'll take questions if anyone wants to ask. Rabin was not a king. He was the prime minister of Israel. He was a democratically elected leader. But in the days and weeks after the assassination, the two brothers, Yigal and Haggai, write letters home where they try to explain to their family why they did what they did. And it's a big shock to the family. And both of them, it's very clear, both from their confessions and their letters, that they viewed Rabin as the linchpin to this whole peace process. Rabin was the linchpin because he was Mr. Security, because he had this record of war, and that that war was the war where Israel captured the West Bank and Gaza. So when critics of the Oslo process said this is too big a risk, it's too big of a security risk, it was very hard to argue with Rabin. You know, when Rabin said it's okay for Israel to take these risks on behalf of this peace process. So Rabin was a linchpin to the deal, to the process itself. Amir and Haggai are thinking, he is the guy we have to assassinate. And they put the assassination in the broader context of the long arc of Jewish history, you know, of prophets and kings. In the days after the assassination, Haggai writes a letter, the brother writes a letter where he says, according to Judaism, killing a king is profoundly significant. It affects the entire nation and alters its destiny. I read that letter about 17 or 18 years after it was written, and I found it chilling and prescient, and that is one of the reasons I wrote this book. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you, prior to the assassination, the rhetoric of the right wing, extreme right wing in Israel, was ramping up. They called him a traitor, everything else. How much did that thing that was all current at the time influence this young assassin, if any? And secondly, what is, in your opinion, the lasting effect of this?
Two tough ones. let me start with the first one. So, yes, there was a campaign on behalf of the critics of Oslo, on people on the right, a campaign against Rabin and against the process that began with small demonstrations, and then it was larger rallies, and it really got quite ugly. The rhetoric got quite ugly, and it included things like calling Rabin, Rabin is a murderer, Rabin is a traitor. People would gather every Friday under his window. He lived on the 12th floor of an apartment building in North Tel Aviv and would chant, Rabin is a traitor. Also holding signs of Rabin dressed like Arafat, Rabin in a keffiyeh, or Rabin even in an SS uniform on some occasions. And there is a notion, certainly among Israelis on the left, that this created this atmosphere where Amir felt legitimized and felt the legitimacy to act and to act violently, that it was an atmosphere of violence. Now, I spent a lot of time thinking about this. It was one, going into the process of writing the book, I had some number of questions that I wanted to figure out, and that was one of them. And I went to sleep with this question and woke up with this question. In fact, with both of those questions, what was the impact of the assassination? In fact, on the issue of the rhetoric, the inflammatory rhetoric, I think my tendency going in was to believe that idea that it did have a real impact. I think it's intuitive. You know, when people create this atmosphere that legitimizes something, I think it's easier for the extremists to do these terrible things. I have to say, I think during the course of coming to understand Amir's psyche, I backed off a little bit from that theory. Not because what was said and done wasn't ugly, maybe even crossed the lines of legality, but Amir was so self-possessed and cocky and full of bluster. And just knew what he was doing and what he wanted to do, didn't really care a lot about what politicians said. And so, I think if you take that inflammatory rhetoric out of the equation, I'm not sure you don't still have an assassination. Now, one thing I will say, there was some group of rabbis on the far right who talked in the period leading up to the assassination about this idea that a death sentence hung over Rabin for these Talmudic doctrines, Din Rodef and Din Moser. This was not something people talked about in the mainstream. As a journalist, I don't remember hearing those terms until after the assassination. But in certain religious seminaries, in certain synagogues, in certain lectures, there is some group of rabbis on the far right who are talking about this. That, I think, did have an impact on Amir. He cared a lot about the idea that this notion, and he had this notion as well, he talked about it, but he wanted to know what the rabbis thought. He tries to seek out rabbis. I think one question that's never been resolved, and one of the interrogators, one of the chief investigators in the case told me this, never fully clear whether there was a rabbi or some number of rabbis that Amir consulted who then gave their blessing to this idea that it's okay to assassinate Rabin. So I think that did have a bigger effect. I'll be a little bit quicker on the second one. What was the lasting impact? I think that moment changed Israel in all kinds of ways. I think the question that we all want to know, and I certainly wanted to know going in, was what happens if there was no assassination? Would the peace process have succeeded? And I think, unfortunately, I don't have an answer to that. Unfortunately, because I think when an event alters the course of history, there's so many variables. It's just very hard to fathom what would have happened if you take that event out of history. I think an honest historian, an honest journalist, you have to kind of come to terms with the fact that we just don't know. I will say this, it was a very hopeful time. There were these things that I remember that are, hard to imagine today happening. Part of the Oslo process involved Israeli and Palestinian security people patrolling in the West Bank and Gaza together, getting into the same jeep every day, some group of them four and four or five and five, and these patrols all around the West Bank, and going around and looking out for their own joint interests, their joint security interests. Now, it's enough to read the headlines today to know that this is unimaginable today. It was a very hopeful moment, and in some ways it was hopeful because all the violence, the suicide bombings, the wars that have happened since then, the settlement expansion, that for Palestinians really feels like that is eroding the thing that they're bargaining for, the thing that they're hoping to get out of some negotiation, keeps shrinking as the settlements expand. The process in 1995 hadn't been poisoned yet by all those things. The leaders, Rabin and Arafat, are the deciders of their generation. I don't think Oslo was a slam dunk. It was a troubled agreement from the get-go. But if Oslo had a chance, it was probably then, and it was probably these two leaders. I dare say even if the two-state solution ever had a chance, it was probably at the time. I can't think of a moment in the 20 years that passed up until today where the chances looked as good as they did then. That was a long answer. Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Jewish Life on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Dan Efron, author of Killing a King, the subject of which is the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin by Orthodox Jew Yigal Amir 20 years ago. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Jewish Life and the Jewish Federation of Omaha, and part of Omaha's 42nd year of celebrating Jewish Book Month, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday evening, November 30th, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Mary Sue Grossman, program coordinator with the Center for Jewish Life, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.